The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place. That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the newly award-nominated show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. Now, Kieran, obviously it's lovely that we've been nominated for the Football Supporters Association Fan Media Award, but it's a public vote and we're up against the likes of the Anfield Rap, so that's going to take a lot of seasonal adjusting if we're going to win, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to coming sixth in the five-horse race, actually.
Well, as you know, several years ago, I was BAFTA-nominated for a writing thing, and I lost to somebody who'd been dead for four decades. So I can't let that disappointment happen again. So we will, between now and the end of February, be throwing in the occasional... We're too cool to beg for votes, Kieran, but we'll do the odd ironic mention that, you know, if you want to vote for us, feel free, vote for us in the Football Supporters Association Awards, which you'll find the address later on. Now, Kieran, we've got a special episode today because it's Questions Day, but later in the episode we will hear from Nick DeMarco, QC, the superstar lawyer who played a major role in the recent decision to scrap the salary cap in League One and League Two. He's known, as you know, Kieran, as the Lionel Messi of sports law, which I think makes us the David Luiz of podcasting. So we look good, but we have the occasional rush of blood to the head. I was about to have a go at him for calling himself the Lionel Messi of sports laws, but apparently that's not the moniker he gave himself, Kieran, is it?
No, I believe some football finance bloke described him that way in one of the newspapers, and it stuck. Yes. And if it is going to stick, you know, that's a nickname I'd quite enjoy myself.
Well, he's obviously so furious about it because he's got it on his tweet profile. So clearly, it's mind you, we had Max Meyer at Palace, who was the self-styled Lionel Messi of German football, and that didn't end particularly well. So let's get on with some questions, Kieran, while we wait for Nick DeMarco, QC. And we're both quite intrigued as to whether we call him Nick, Q. What do we call him? I don't know.
I think Q's been taken by James Bond, hasn't it? So.
Oh, okay. We're working on fictional characters, Kieran. Right, so our first question comes from Max Bamford. Max, I'm sure everybody asks you this, but if you are related to Patrick, you could ask him on behalf of many clubs why it's taken him so bleeding long to start playing decent football. But Max Bamford has asked us, what is stopping owners who presumably own other businesses as well as football clubs, from merging all their companies into one to improve profitability and circumvent FFP? Mike Ashley with Newcastle and Sports Direct, for example.
Well, Mike Ashley has indeed done that. Newcastle United Football Club and Newcastle United and the other two dozen companies, they are all ultimately owned by a company called Mash Holdings, which is stands for Mike Ashley's Special Help something. I don't know what the M and the A stand for, but I wasn't quite sure what the S and the H.
Kieran, seriously, can I just point out here, we're trying to win a podcast award here, Kieran. That we were asking people to vote for us. We can't have that level of what I don't know-y sort of stuff. Really? We've just lost 10 votes here already. Well, I'm surprised you didn't go for special handling, knowing you.
So this company, Mash Holdings, owns 550 companies all around the world, from the likes of Estonia, the United States, Belgium, you name it. Mike Ashley's got a company there. But You then have to take a look at the Premier League handbook. Now, as you know, it's always a book which is close to my heart, 550 pages of regulations. And I went into the small print. In terms of trying to circumvent financial fair play, it is the accounts of the club that matter. And the word club with a capital C is defined in the Premier League handbook. And the definition says you have to be an association football club. So Mash Holdings, which owns Sports Direct, owns the Frasers Group, owns Evans Cycles, as well as Newcastle United and many other companies, is not an association football club. So therefore, its accounts could not be used to determine financial fair play. And exactly the same is the case in respect of Stoke City Football Club, which itself is owned by Bet365, Liverpool Football Club, which ultimately is owned by the Fenway Sports Group, and so on and so forth.
So would those same rules apply to European clubs then, Kieran? Because Barcelona, for example, are not just a football club, are they? They're a sporting club. So do UEFA have a different criteria for FFP here?
Well, as far as I can make out, what Barcelona will have to do is to separate out the football and the non-footballing elements within the accounts and will be assessed on that basis.
Right. And when you say Mike Ashley has got these companies all over the world, are they all Sports Direct? Or has he got a handle in, I was going to say, a finger in many different pies, but I'd realise what sort of route I was going down if I said that, Kieran.
They are a variety. Some are Sports Direct. In fact, it's rather weird that every single branch of Sports Direct is set up as a separate company. So you've got one for Scunthorpe, one for Derby, one for Sheffield. Okay. Which is unusual. I'm sure there are benefits to it. And Mike is for all of his faults, and he's a pantomime villain. Certainly as far as the Newcastle United fan base are concerned, he's a very astute guy. And he's currently involved in a very messy legal dispute with Rangers Football Club, which is working its way through the courts. But as well as Sports Direct, remember that he's taken over the House of Fraser, Evans Cycles. He owns brands such as Slazenger and Donne. You and I are old enough to remember tennis from the 1970s when those type of brands were actually quite popular. The companies then fell into hard times, and Mike Ashley is the master of snapping these up.
I have to say, I didn't realise that Mike Ashley was such a global big deal, to be quite honest. I always thought he was, obviously a very good businessman, but kind of just had a couple of businesses, got lucky when he was younger. But clearly, I was wrong, it turns out.
When it comes to making money, he's one of those guys who is able to identify value very, very quickly. And that's to a certain extent a skill which cannot be taught in business school. He backs himself. When he bought Newcastle United Football Club, he did it without doing any due diligence, which would turn the boys in the city, they'd be reaching for the smelling salts. He says, I'm going to do it, agreed a price, and then found out what he bought later on.
Yeah, he strikes me as the sort of bloke who would use the phrase school of hard knocks. That's where I learnt my stuff. Brody Bradford Tom asks our next question. Thank you, Brody, for asking this question. Brody Bradford Tom said, I was wondering whether football clubs can use hedge accounting in any way to get around FFP regulations. Don't get carried away, Brody. We've all been wondering that. Also, to what extent clubs, in particular Spurs, who Brody supports, use special purpose vehicles or SPVs and intellectual property ownership to help players avoid tax. This stems from Brody's own interpretation that Spurs may be using Joe Louis's residence in the Bahamas to register players' intellectual property in order to pay 0% corporate and income tax. I read it, Kieran. I didn't necessarily understand it, although back in the day, I have been in the back of a couple of special purpose vehicles in my time.
Yes. Guy said that we had a hedging question, I thought we were back to our friends at Manscaped. And remember, if you use the code Price of Football, you'll get 20% off the Manscaped 3.0 plus free shipping.
There's another 30 votes down out the window.
Our adverts don't seem to go down particularly well. I think people have been quite traumatised by them.
I think it's the detail you go into. That's why you go way, I was going to say, above and beyond in your description. It's the fact that you so gleefully say, no nicks, guaranteed, no nicks. It's what, anyway.
Yes. Right, well, anyway, back on topic, I guess.
Yes, carry on. I'm fascinated.
I'm sure. For people unfamiliar with hedging, these are the terms which are used in the world of banking and finance. It's things such as options, forex futures, interest rate swaps, and so on. And you know, they are far away from football as far as most of us are concerned. However, given that football today is big business, if you go into the Manchester United 2020 accounts, you will find 83 references to hedging in those accounts. So I counted every single one. And the way that it works is that if you've got a club such as Manchester United, which is based in the US, but from a stock exchange point of view, it's borrowed money in dollars, but it publishes its accounts in the UK, there's a danger that if the exchange rate moves against sterling, Manchester United could end up either paying a lot more interest or having much higher debts than they would otherwise like to be. So you then start to get involved in these futures and options and things of this nature, which gets the accountants and the bankers into a sense of high glee. So it does exist in football. Now, with regards to Brody's question, then sort of moving on to Spurs and special purpose vehicles, most players, and I think we've had this discussion before, most players at the elite level will have a separate company set up which looks after their intellectual property rights. Hmm. And what the clubs will do is that if you've got a player on 200 grand a week, or known as, you know, producer guy's weekly stipend, then you're allowed to say that some of that money is being allocated to the player in respect of his intellectual property rights, and the money is therefore paid across to that company. Now, quite often that company will be located overseas. Does this mean that the player will not be paying any tax? I would say, provided all the rules are followed, that won't be the case. Hmm. Because even if the intellectual property company is based in a tax haven, when you or I are taxed, Kevin, it's based on our worldwide earnings.
Oh, is it?
Yes.
I should have to look into those.
Yes, exactly. So as far as HMRC are concerned, it doesn't matter whether the money is paid to I think Brody mentioned Harry Kane. It doesn't matter whether the money is paid to Harry Kane in Argentina or the Bahamas or Barbados, right, or Jersey or wherever. It all comes under the umbrella, and then it is taxed as if it has effectively been earned in the UK. There is such a thing as called double taxation relief. So if you pay any tax over there, it then gets deducted from what you pay over here. But I don't think it's necessarily used as a vehicle to avoid paying tax. The advantages of these special purpose vehicles is that what you can do is that you can arrange it so that the player doesn't take any money out of these companies until he retires. So, you know, as if you think about it, if you're a football player on 200 grand a week, on the vast majority of your earnings, you're paying 45% tax. Mm. Now, if the player then goes to retire in the Bahamas and he's no longer in the UK, then it could be that he could then take the money out of the special purpose vehicle and be taxed at the rate in the Bahamas, which is likely to be lower than the UK. But, you know, my view of certainly most players brought up in the UK is that they quite like living here, so it won't necessarily be an advantage. But if you think about it, if you're 40 and you're starting to take money out of your intellectual property company, you're not being paid the same money as you would have been getting at the football club. So therefore, you'll be able to pay tax at lower rates. So is it tax efficient? Yes, it is. Is it tax evasion, which is illegal? No, it isn't. Yeah, dog letting himself out.
Even Finlay got bored with that.
Yes, I know.
That was very interesting. I did follow it, and thank you for the question, Brad. I'm slightly confused, okay. I thought the whole point of companies and individuals registering themselves in the Bahamas or Liechtenstein or whatever was to pay less tax. And now you're saying that's not necessarily true because HMRC will tax you as though you'd earn the money here.
Well, if you're smart, what you will do, if you think about a football player, he's got a career of approximately, 12 to 15 years?
Yeah.
And if you are one of these players, what you will do is that after you have retired, so let's say that Harry Kane's picking up his 200 grand a week, HMRC start to get a bit arsey if you take more than 20% out for intellectual property. So he's getting 50 grand a week, which is going to his intellectual property company. Then when he retires at the age of, let's say, at the age of 35 or the age of 40, he can then start to take money out. And if you think about it, you know, the first 12 grand a year, I can't remember what the rates are here in the UK anymore. Your first 12 grand a year, you pay nothing. Then you pay some money at 19%. So what he can do is that he can spread the money he's earning over a lower period of time. So yes, he will end up paying tax at a lower rate over a longer period of time. So there are tax benefits, but there's nothing illegal with it. Unless you've got a dodgy accountant and lawyer, which of course, we would never make such assertions.
Yeah, what Harry Kane wants is a lawyer who says, no, he only earned £11,000. I'm not entirely sure where you got those numbers from. Those references to hedging in the Man United accounts, are they actual references or euphemisms? Because I find, as you know, I like horse racing. I don't gamble. A £10 a week limit, thank you. But betting companies tell you, when there are talk or there is talk of big gambles going on, betting companies tend to be a bit edgy about admitting the fact that they've hedged the bets, they've passed on the liability. So Man United are quite happy in their accounts to talk about the fact that their hedging is happening.
Yes. Oh, yes. And indeed, you've got an obligation to do so. I mean, from a business point of view, it really does make sense. If Manchester United, which in theory is an English company, although it's registered in the Cayman Islands, it's looking to publish accounts in sterling. Now, if sterling takes a hammering against the dollar, you could end up owing an awful lot more money. So what you can do is you can do forward swaps, you can do interest rate swaps and things of this nature, which restrict in exactly the same way as the bookies do. So let's say that somebody goes to a bookies and puts £100,000 on the price of football to win the Football Supporters Association Fan Media of the Year award. Mm-hmm. Bookies might say, that's a lot of money. Presently, those odds are quite high, to put it mildly. So what we will do, we'll take that £100,000 bet and then we will lay that off with other bookies to restrict the worst case scenario from our point of view. It's exactly the same with interest rates, with currencies and things of that nature in the world of business. And the sums involved in these transactions, we are talking trillions of dollars a day. I think people are completely unaware as to how these organizations are making money, but because it's not interesting, but it is very lucrative.
Yeah, Kieran, it's your lucky day, because not only are we talking to the legal Lionel Messi, but we have several proper accounting questions, and the next one comes from Paul Edwards. And Paul says, recently, Kieran, you explained about impairment being the writing down of the value of a player, but what would happen if a player was bought for, say, £50 million to be amortised by £10 million each for 5 years, but then got injured in his first game and had to retire? If the full £50 million had to be taken as a cost in 1 year, how would that be treated for FFP? And presumably there's a double whammy for the club because the team then has to buy a replacement.
It's tough potatoes, I think, is the technical phrase here, as far as the club is concerned. It is a risk that you take when you recruit a player, pay a large sum of money for him. He could get injured or B, turn out to be Andy Carroll. Neither of which have proven to be particularly successful financially. So what will happen under those circumstances in theory is that you would have to write off the whole cost of the player. Let's say he has his terrible injury, which is tragic on a personal level. Yeah, and anybody that's ever listened to Dean Ashton talk about his career, he's a player who I've always thought he was going to be a real find for England. You know, it's such a tragedy. Then the club potentially is going to have to just bear that as a cost. But what it would do is that if they've got an insurance policy, the write-off would be net of the insurance proceeds. For FFP purposes, if the club was close to the limit, they could put in an appeal to the Premier League to say these are extraordinary circumstances, and it would be held, you know, heard with I suspect a degree of sympathy by the football authorities themselves. Mm.
Andy Carroll's actually a very nice young man, and he told us how he was the helpful recipient of some brilliant advice from Kevin Nolan one day. He was telling us how difficult it was to go out in Newcastle without being mobbed, and it's very, very hard for him. And he said, then one day Kevin Nolan just looked me in the eyes and said, "Don't go out."
He thought
that was the best bit of advice he'd ever got, because we were saying to him, "Well, why don't you go out in Sunderland? That might help." Our next question comes from Jake Arben, and Jake Arben's question is about his club, Stockport County, and their recent logo change. Jake explains it's still the old club crest, but it's now in an arty type of circle, a la Man City, Brentford, Bristol City, and many others. And Jake is curious as to why the new owner has changed it. Is it easier to mass produce and therefore money saving? If so, surely it affects our brand identity if our logo looks the same as many other clubs, especially Rochdale, which is just down the road. It can't be easier to mass produce because the Stockport crest is really complicated, whether it's in a circle or not.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Because I used to live in Stockport, and I used to go to Edgeley Park on a Friday night, because it was great. You know, you could get two matches in a weekend. And then I discovered that my girlfriend at the time didn't appreciate it the same extent that I did. So became an ex-girlfriend at her behest, I hasten to add. Which meant was fine. Yeah, I consoled myself to go into Edgeley Park on a Friday night alone.
I just love the fact some people would say she chucked me. You just said she became an ex-girlfriend at her behest. That's a lovely account. It's a lovely accounting euphemism.
I was binned.
Yes. Anyway,
in terms of this, quite often when a new owner comes to the club, they're looking at all aspects of trying to increase the appeal, the awareness, the profile of the club. And there will be somebody who's, you know, they've got a friend in marketing who says, "Well, I've taken a look at your badge. You know, that looks 1920s. Mm. We're now in 2020s. We need to update it." So if you take a look at, you know, organisations such as BT and BP, they keep changing their corporate logos because they want it to reflect something more modern. So that's normally the driving force. And I'm sort of inclined, along with sort of Jake, to think this is slightly counterproductive, because as football fans, we're actually quite conservative.
Mm.
I remember when Brighton changed its crest. Yeah, we went from being the Dolphins to the Seagulls, and at the time there were lots of, you know, lots of men tutting, as is their way.
Well, there's a lot of Palace fans tutting as well, because it was a shameful rip off of our shameful rip off of Benfica's badge.
the other reason why it's done is to extend the brand. So if you take a look at Manchester United, for example, the Manchester United crest used to be Manchester United Football Club. It is now Manchester United, i.e. they want to extend the club to being beyond the football club.
Yeah, of course.
And also, it could be simpler for registering from an intellectual property point of view overseas, where if you've got an existing logo, does that count under intellectual property laws in that country and things of this nature? So you create a new one, you register it in as many countries as possible, and you try to protect the brand from that point of view.
Now, as you know, Kieran and I are two smooth operators. One of us, literally, because this episode of The Price of Football is brought to you by our below-the-waist grooming partner, Manscaped, which offers the finest tools for your family jewels.
Absolutely. And the Manscaped Perfect Package 3.0, which is their latest and greatest, includes the Lawnmower 3.0, which is waterproof, so you can play with it in the shower. It's skin safe, so that's going to reduce the likelihood of nicks on your two best friends. It even has a light, which helps you to spot bits that you've perhaps missed otherwise. Mm-hmm. And every lawn, Kevin, needs a bit of TLC. So, as well as the lawnmower, you have the Crop Preserver, an anti-chafing ball deodorant and moisturizer, the Crop Reviver, which is a ball toner spray. And you put all of those together, and that's also going to help unintentional flossing. And on top of that, we get a travel bag called The Shed and a set of boxer briefs, which are really good to reduce chafing.
That's a big package. And if you want to be hair-free, care-free, go to manscaped.com and get 20% off plus free shipping using the code PRICEOFFOOTBALL. That's 20% off and free shipping with manscaped.com with the code PRICEOFFOOTBALL. Sussex is not full of dolphins anyway, is it? Not even in the Sea Life Centre or whatever it's that place where the turtles is called.
Oh, well, no, we used to have a dolphinarium next to the pier, because I used to go there when I was a kid. And then it was absolutely tragic. There was some complete bell end that put in too much chlorine or something into the dolphin pool. And it was a horrendous story at the time. It was just absolutely appalling. So we it's now called a Sea Life Centre, but yeah. They no longer have the performing dolphins.
Quite right, too. It just confirms everything I think about Brighton being an irresponsible town. If you can't look after dolphins, you don't deserve dolphins, Kieran.
I'm inclined to agree.
Not that, Carl. I'm loath to admit this because it sounds a little bit childish. But you know, in the good old days when you could have a day out, and Ali would say, "Shall we? How about we just go to Brighton for the day?" I'd go, "No," because I didn't want to take the risk that you know I was buying fish and chips off a Brighton fan. Basically, I didn't in any way want to help the local economy in any way, shape, or form.
You're more of a budgie man than dolphin man, I understand these days.
Yes. My dad has acquired two budgies, yes. That's a very long story, but they're keeping him happy, although, and I quote, "I've got a weight on a man and foot." and he's made the cage more masculine. I'm going around to see the more masculine cage this afternoon. I only saw it on Friday. I dread to think what happens. Anyway, our next question comes from Dominic Kammerman, and it's a hypothetical question, Kieran, but I think it's a very interesting hypothetical question, and the way things are going, who knows, it could actually happen. Dominic says, assuming a lender gives a loan to two different football clubs in the Championship and receives a share pledge as collateral, if both clubs then default on their obligations and the lender makes use of that security to take over the club, whether it's to sell or put into administration or liquidation, would this contradict the principle that the same company cannot own two clubs in the same competition, and how could this be solved? I mean, it doesn't seem likely at the moment, but I think it is a clever and interesting question, actually.
Yeah, it's certainly a potential issue. The rules in respect of football clubs is that you cannot own. I think there are thresholds. I mean, I'm not going to name the clubs, but I actually own shares in a few football clubs in both England and Scotland because this allows me to gain access to their annual reports earlier than I would do under Companies House. Sneaky.
It's very sneaky. Do Companies House know about this, Kieran?
No, they don't need to know.
You've used that expression before, haven't you?
I'm from South London. So the threshold that we tend to be looking at is 9.9%. If you own more than 9.9% of the shares in two clubs in the same country or same division, broadly under football rules, there is an issue. There's a problem because you'll have influence over those clubs, and you know one of those clubs could be going for a Champions League place, relegation, promotion, blah blah blah. Mm. So therefore, those are the thresholds, and that makes a lot of sense. And you've got to give credit to both the Premier League and the EFL for having such thresholds to help ensure the integrity of the game. If you are a lender, and as Dominic raised, and I think it is an intriguing issue. If both clubs went into administration, if both clubs had the lender call in the loans for whatever reason, you would have to be able to set up initially some form of Chinese walls to ensure that there are two different management companies in control of the club. And then there would be liaison with the Premier League and the EFL with a commitment by the bank or the lender to sell one of those clubs within an agreed period of time. I mean, the other alternative is that, you know, potentially you could get the Premier League or the EFL to have appoint non-executive directors to ensure that as far as decisions are being made, that those are being made along the lines of integrity, to ensure that no untoward behaviour or preference was given, especially when those two clubs were up against each other, either directly or indirectly.
But from the lender's point of view, Kieran, we've seen the Bank of England giving money to a couple of clubs recently. I presume from a lender's point of view, you wouldn't want to lend money to too many football clubs, would you, in case that there was a general sort of collapse in football? And also, if one of the clubs goes under, it could have a knock-on effect on the others that you've lent money to in the first place. So you wouldn't want to put too much money in that one basket, would you, presumably?
Well, it's yes and no. You know, from a lender's point of view, that they're looking to make money. So we've seen this company appear from nowhere over the course of 12 to 18 months, MSD Holdings. Mm. And that's lent to Southampton, to the owners of Burnley. It's had an arrangement with Sunderland. It's lent money to Derby County and so on. And also there's an Australian investment bank which is doing the same. So it is theoretically possible. I mean, I guess the lenders take the view that first of all they've done their due diligence when it comes to the ability of the borrowers to repay, just like all lenders should do if they got any sense. Mm. And then if the worst happens, then they will be able to set up some form of claims of independence in terms of the management. No lenders want borrowers to go out of business because it's easy money. You know, the lenders to Manchester United have earned over £800 million in interest since the Glazers took over the company, and they're quite happy for those loans to carry on because if you think about it, if you're a lender, you've got somebody that's repaying you on a regular basis on the right dates. It's zero hassle. You don't have to go and monitor them to the same extent. They've got a reputation as a good payer. You know, just collect the check.
Mm, I'm not sure I agree with the word earned in that sentence. Received, shall we say.
Yes.
And just as a matter of interest, Kieran, I'm assuming now that you've got shares in, I'm going to guess, 68 clubs. How many shares do you need to own before you get access to special information? Is it just one share?
Just one share per club.
Simple. Oh, that's it.
Yeah, you are a shareholder. You're entitled to attend the AGM. You're entitled to receive a set of the accounts from the club secretary if you apply via an email and so on and so forth.
I bet finance directors would love it just to see the door open just as the meeting starts and Kieran Maguire's framed there like Clint Eastwood in a spaghetti western. Our next question comes from Debashish Sikdar. I hope I pronounced that right. I was so worried about not pronouncing it right, I probably haven't. And also because I do struggle with SHs in the middle of sentences, but Debashish Sikdar has asked, how do big brands calculate the opportunity costs of buying a club in terms of sponsorship? For example, nation states that advertise Etihad or Qatar Airways won't be able to put their brand on the shirts of Real Madrid or Man United, for example, which would offer a huge platform that they're missing. Is that something that's calculated?
I don't think so, and I think what Debashish is inferring here or implying here.
He implies, you infer, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I'm We both know I failed my English O-level in 1978.
I don't know why I'm laughing. It's tragic, but, you know, I don't want you to sound like, what's his face? Terrible Top Gear man.
Clarkson.
Jeremy Clarkson, yes.
I've never been likened to Jeremy Clarkson.
Well, no, I was just about to do it, but I don't want you to become one of those people who like him every year exam results come out going, I failed my O-levels, didn't do me any harm, did it? So, yeah, let's not boast about you failing your O-levels, Kieran, even though
I'm not. It's something which bugs me still at the age of almost 60.
You're like Clarkson. You're now a globally successful brand. You know, the only difference is you don't punch people in the face if your pie's cold. Guy, don't worry about that legally. That's fine. We've been through this on many TV shows. He did punch him, and it was because his pie was cold. But I'll leave a gap because Guy's a nervous bloke anyway.
Back to Debashish's issue. The concern here is that if you are United Arab Emirates and you buy Manchester City, it effectively means that you can't use Manchester United as a advertising platform because clearly there's a rivalry between the club. Yeah. So that means is it a lost opportunity? Yes, it is. But I think the attitude taken by these nation states is that we will generate so much publicity on the pitch through footballing achievement that will more than replace the opportunities lost to not advertise our brand on the shirts of rivals. So I don't see it as being too much of an issue. And given the way that Manchester City are playing at present, I think they've got a fantastic return on their investment in terms of improving the awareness of Etihad as a brand, but also, you know, indirectly, therefore, the acknowledgement that UAE are involved in football.
Yeah, it would be nice, Kieran, if we were allowed to talk about just football on this pod sometimes without producer Guy getting furious, but... Because a five-minute chat about what a good football club Man City are, it's almost hard to believe they're playing the same game as Palace sometimes. The fact there's a ball involved makes you think, yeah, I think it probably is football, but they seem to be doing it a different way than we do it. They're joy to watch, aren't they? Beautiful. Leo Townsend has our next question. And budding podcast presenters, if there are anybody out there, look out for a masterclass in dealing with a tricky problem when I ask this question. Just you'll get what I'm getting at. Just take notes if you want to be a presenter. Leo says, I'm a Shrewsbury fan, but the Wrexham takeover got me thinking, could a club like Shrewsbury or Wrexham, who play in the English League, also own a club that fields a team in the League of Wales? Could there be any financial benefits to this, and could it help avoid academy players being poached by putting them through the Welsh system? Did you know, Kieran, the way I said Shrewsbury and Shrewsbury there?
I can see you're a professional presenter, Kevin.
To my toes, except I just realised I forgot to look up the FA of Wales attitude. Because this is a hornet's nest, isn't it? Because if anybody from the Welsh Football Association listening to this will be giving a different answer to the one you possibly give. This episode of The Price of Football is brought to you by the AI-powered workspace Notion. We are living in an era of information overload and we have more knowledge than ever before. But what do we do with it all? If you're in Notion, you put that knowledge to work.
It's a workspace designed not just for making progress, but getting inspired. And all I can say on a personal level, as for somebody whose life is quite chaotic and I'm writing pieces for government and newspapers and media content. I've got my university commitments and I'm supposed to be writing a book. I use Notion all the time because it brings order into chaos.
Well, if you need order brought to your chaos, you can try Notion for free when you go to notion.com/priceoffootball. That's all lowercase letters, notion.com/priceoffootball, and start turning your ideas into action. That's notion.com/priceoffootball.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Well, I estimate that there's absolutely nothing to have an element of multi-club ownership, with one club being based in the realm of the English Football Association and one in the Welsh. Because we've seen the City Football Group own clubs in Belgium and France, so therefore, yeah, that, and of course England, so therefore that all comes within UEFA. They own clubs elsewhere in the world as well. So could it happen as far as Wales is concerned? Absolutely nothing to stop that. I'm not quite sure. I see the benefits in terms of linking to academy players and giving them protection, unless it is. And I have to apologise here. I've not looked at the FA of Wales detailed rule book in respect of how players can be transferred to English clubs. But I suspect there won't be too much protection, given that all that will happen is that the English clubs will offer some form of compensation. And, you know, given where Wrexham and Shrewsbury are at present, the fees they're going to be commanding for these players aren't likely to be too high.
Yeah, how would that? I mean, we've already talked about FFP and multiple businesses, etc. So, presumably, if that did happen, each club would have a different set of accounts, wouldn't they? The English club and the Welsh club would presumably have to have a different set of accounts for FFP then.
Yes, they would. And here there is the scope. I'm not saying this would happen, of course. There is the scope to play fast and loose with the numbers.
Mm.
You can centralise certain costs. You can allocate certain costs more to one club than another to ensure that it's within the realms of financial fair play. So can this be done? Yes, it can. Is it being done? I couldn't possibly comment.
I'd be interested, if there is anybody from the FA of Wales listening to this, I'd be interested to hear what they think about this as a theoretical possibility. Because I know if you talk to fans of Newport, when Newport reformed again, the theory was that the FA of Wales would have been much more cooperative if the new Newport had played in Welsh football rather than English football. So I'd be interested to see what, because if you imagine, Kieran, if it could be done, it would be done. But on a similar note, our last question comes from Kieran Simmons. And again, this is one of those really simple questions that you think somebody should have asked this before, because it's quietly very clever. Kieran says, why would an investor not buy a League of Ireland club when there is Champions League football available and three Europa League places? It would cost very little to buy and the return could be massive. Am I missing something?
The cost of buying the club would certainly be very low, and the FAI, the Football Association of Ireland, I think it is fair to say it's in turmoil. And once again, I will recommend the book Champagne Football, which has gone into how it was almost destroyed as an entity by the largesse of one individual. But whilst Kieran's right to say that there is the opportunity to get into both the Europa League and Champions League, the money in both of those competitions only arises once you get through to the group stage. And the clubs from the FA of Ireland, because Ireland has a fairly low UEFA ranking, they've got no automatic places in the group games. So therefore, you're having to go through potentially three preliminary rounds. Now, the money in the preliminary rounds is worth, in the main, somewhere between 230,000 and 380,000 euro. So by the time you buy the club, you then have to get it up to a sufficiently decent standard to get into the group stage. So the group stages of the Champions League are worth a minimum of 15 million a year. So it's certainly, you know, very exciting to get there. But yeah, who have you got to beat? Well, you know, you've got clubs of the stature of Rangers and Celtic, for example. Mm. But, you know, so the Scottish League, and those clubs are turning over 50 million pounds a year. clubs in the League of Ireland. Again, let's go back to basics. Where do football clubs get their money from? Through the turnstiles, through the TV deal, through the commercial deals. Well, the TV deal is not worth having in Ireland. The commercial deals are mainly local, and the vast majority of football fans in Ireland tend to support clubs in the Premier League. You know, they've got huge fan bases for Arsenal, Manchester United, Liverpool, and so on. So the crowds are solid, but they are not ticking the dial in the same way as many of the other clubs they'll be competing against in Europe. If they were guaranteed Champions League places as far as the group stages were concerned, then yes, it would be a no-brainer in terms of making that investment, because you could get a very nice return. But the filtration system, which is the preliminary rounds, actually doesn't make it that lucrative. And by the time you've bought the club, get it up to a decent standard so that it's high in the FAI, and then paid the wages, you know, the 200 grand a year you're getting from getting knocked out in the second round by Belarusians, Russian runners-up, which again isn't going to tick the dial in terms of generating a big crowd, probably doesn't make it worthwhile.
Mm-hmm. Interview time, Kieran. My original introduction to our guest was going to be, now, there aren't many famous lawyers, but it turns out historically there are loads of them. So I looked them up. Cherie Blair, Clive Anderson, Abraham Lincoln, loads. But there definitely aren't many famous football lawyers, and I'm pleased to say we spoke to the cream of that crop, Nick DeMarco QC, fresh from his victory on behalf of the PFA against the League One, League Two salary cap. Nick, welcome to the show. Thank you very much for joining us. I've deliberately kept the number of questions down because I suspect very few of them will be yes, no answers. But can we start with something that we have been talking about on the pod a lot recently, that successful action to scrap the salary cap? Why did it have to go, and were you always confident of the outcome?
Well, I'm never overconfident about the outcome of any case, because all cases have some real risk with them. With this one, I think there's two reasons why it had to go. The first is a purely legal answer to your question. And the reason the case was determined the way it was, it is because, as some of your listeners may know, the EFL, like the Premier League, has for a long time agreed that there will be, and I'll quote from the constitution, which is public, no major changes to the regulations of the leagues affecting a player's terms and conditions of employment without full discussion and agreement in the PFNCC. The PFNCC is the Professional Footballing Negotiating and Consultative Committee. It's a collective bargaining agreement under trade union law. So you had this agreement that the EFL was part of, that they wouldn't change a regulation affecting a player's terms without discussion and agreement in the PFNCC. And so when they started discussing bringing in salary caps, the PFA said, well, obviously, you have to bring this to the PFNCC for agreement. And the EFL said, no, we don't, because effectively their argument was a salary cap does not affect a player's terms and conditions of employment. Now, you can make of that argument what you will, but you'll see what the independent judicial panel made of it. And that is the reason why the case, the PFA's case, won. It was really simply about the construction of a contract and trade union law. So that's why it had to go. I mean, there are much broader questions about why it should go or shouldn't go that various of us have. My own opinion is that the League One and League Two salary cap was fundamentally flawed, because it prevented clubs that could afford to pay higher salaries, those salaries, at a time when we need more investment in football. It was a sort of rush to the bottom type cap, which meant that the clubs with the lowest income would set it at a level they could afford to stop others competing with them. And that doesn't help competition. It's incompatible, in my view, with the pyramid structure of English football. And it doesn't sit well with a system in which clubs are allowed to trade in football players, sell them for the highest price, or buy them for whatever they can afford, but then are limited in what they can actually pay them as a salary. So I think for all those reasons, salary caps just don't work in football in the way they might seem to work in a lot of American sports.
Mm. I don't know if you're one for checking your Twitter feed, Nick, but Andy Holt, the owner of Accrington, responded to the outcome with his view that beating the EFL at anything was like taking sweets from a baby.
Yeah. I mean, I respect Mr. Holt because he's put a lot of his own money into Accrington Stanley and they're doing very well. So, you know, he's fully entitled to his opinion. I'm not sure how well informed it is because, and it's no criticism of him, he hasn't had the opportunity to read the reasons for the decision, to look at the arguments at EFL, who also had a, you know, one of the top QCs in the country in sports law arguing for them. They considered all of those arguments and an independent panel rejected them. So he hasn't had a chance to read those reasons because, unfortunately, the EFL has yet to agree to them being published, despite the fact they're of obviously interest to everybody in football, whatever side of the argument they have. I'm sure if he did read it, he might reach a different view about the EFL and its case.
Kieran Maguire, my illustrious partner on this pod, has a great nose for a story, but even he only hears of the very few cases that get to a court or tribunal. Are there many others that are being resolved before they reach that far?
Yes, there are. I mean, there's the truth is that although it's a kind of crude separation, you could probably say that in sport, there's two different types of cases. There's the commercial private disputes between clubs, which are often made in accordance with regulations. So the Harvey Elliott case was a commercial dispute between two clubs. And then there's a dispute where the regulators on one side, like the Premier League or the FA or whoever. And those regulatory disputes are much more difficult to settle because the regulator will consider it's got a duty to all its stakeholders and clubs to come to a particular result, whereas the commercial disputes are much more likely to settle because you've got just two parties. And usually, I'd say in most cases, there is a commercial deal to be done.
Yeah, oddly enough, I didn't want to ask you particularly about individual cases, but the Harvey Elliott things is something that our listeners have been referring to for a while. And that was actually, I think you'd say, a very good outcome for Fulham, wasn't it?
Well, Fulham have said they're very happy with the outcome, so that's what matters. they're the client. I mean, it was a record-breaking award for a 16-year-old player who had never signed a professional contract, and obviously that meant Harvey Elliott was allowed to leave Fulham and join Liverpool without any transfer fee because he was not a contracted player. But Harvey Elliott is a exceptional player. He'd been the youngest player to ever play in the Premier League. This season, when he's been on loan to Blackburn, he's, I think, the joint high assist in championship goals. And that's for a 17-year-old player in one of the most competitive leagues in the world. So he is an exceptional player. And the reason why this sort of training conversation is important is that clubs like Fulham invest millions in academies. So Fulham's got a very good category one, it's called Youth Academy, that produced Ryan Sessegnon and others before Harvey Elliott. And, you know, when you put in millions and let's say you train 40 people a year or so, young players, you're lucky, you're doing well if you get one star out of that cohort. And if that one star leaves, and you don't get any money at all for that star, why are you going to carry on investing in those 40 players every year? So it's for the benefit of the game, in my view, that you do have proportionate compensation. And that does depend on the type of player that's moving.
Does a case going to court or arbitration represent a failure of negotiation at a lower level, Nick?
Often it does. I mean, despite appearances, I can tell you that I rarely encourage my clients to go to court or arbitration. I usually tell them that it's very risky. It's very costly. It takes a lot of time. However strong you think your case is, things can go wrong. And if there is a way of dealing with it commercially or by a deal with the regulator in some way, which there can be before charges are brought, then you should explore that. That's a much better use of your time and resources than paying lawyers. And often that is the case. We often are able to do deals. And so that's certainly usually my advice to clients. It's only when it's really impossible that you have to go through and fight.
Do you have to be a football fan to be a football lawyer, Nick?
No, I don't think you have to be a football fan. It probably helps because it might mean you get more enjoyment. But, you know, I've done cases in cricket, and I can't claim to be a cricket fan, I'm afraid, and in lots of other sports where I'm not a fan. I think it does help to understand the football industry. You know, I mean, there are lots of pundits out there who understand football, like who's a good winger or whatever, a lot better than I do. I've sometimes sat with them at football matches and am really impressed at how they read the game. But understanding the football industry, which is a very unique and specific industry, is something that probably is very helpful for a football lawyer.
It's interesting to hear you say that, because I think I know football. I've been around football as a fan and as a pundit and as a broadcaster for many, many years, but and I thought before doing this pod that I understood the football industry, as I thought it was kind of a cottage industry writ large. But I realised even after a year with Kieran very patiently explaining to me that I'm so far from getting a handle on the football industry, and I think that's the case for most football fans, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is, because it is such a strange industry, and it is really kind of behind closed doors. Mm. I mean, I was lucky enough about 15 years ago to be a director at QPR for a short period of time. And it was one of the most stressful, awful times of my life, because the club had no money. It was on the brink of administration all the time. And of course, the fans are fantastic, but they will always blame the owners if something's going wrong with the club. So it's really stressful and difficult. And you don't get paid for being a football director, or at least I didn't in those days. But it was the most invaluable learning experience about exactly how the club runs, its finances, the sponsorship deals, dealing with agents, transfers, regulations, all that stuff, which you don't really see unless you look at it from the inside. And it is mostly, as I say, behind closed doors. Kieran, if I can give him a plug, has done a brilliant job with his book, because it's the first book I've read that actually shines a proper spotlight on how football finances work, which is really one of the key things now.
Yeah, I'm guessing that Kieran will be preening himself as we speak, but I'm also guessing, I mean, lawyers have obviously been around football since wealthy men started forming clubs in Victorian times. But for how long has professional football lawyer been a career path? It seems to me that it's a relatively new development, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And I'm not even sure if I would narrow it down to football career path as opposed to just sports law. Sports law as a whole is quite new as an industry that can actually employ people permanently to do it. And that is a result of the greater commercialization of sport. And of course, football is the sport with the most money in the world. It's the most popular sport in the world. And English football is economically the most successful in the world. So it follows that there will be more work in that sector, perhaps, than any other sports sector. But you still have to realise that it's a relatively small. It gets a lot of headlines and some players' wages are very high. But when you compare the turnover of a Premier League club to other companies, I think I read somewhere, not in Kieran's book, but in someone else's, that a big soups, Tesco or other brands apply superstore has a similar turnover to a Premier League club. Mm. And Tesco will have hundreds of superstores up and down the country. So it's relative to other parts of our GDP and commerce, it's still a very small sector.
Nick, you may be the Lionel Messi of sports law, but please don't be mentioning other people's books on the pod. you made Kieran so happy two questions ago, and now he's all up. What do you make now?
I can't even remember who wrote it.
Probably Swiss Ramble, I guess. I'm going to bring Kieran in on this after this next answer, Nick, if you don't mind. But what do you make of players like Raheem Sterling, who decided recently to ditch agents and instead use lawyers and solicitors for occasional advice?
Well, I mean, I don't know the circumstances of that case, so I can't comment on the case. But Raheem is obviously a really highly successful player. He's got a great deal in terms of his wages, and he's also, I think, very media savvy as well. And so it doesn't surprise me that someone who's reached the pinnacle he has might make that decision. And, you know, other players in a similar position might also make that kind of decision. And then you've got players at the other end of the spectrum who perhaps are only ever going to get one small professional contract in their life, and they may not need an agent. But I think for the vast majority of professional players in between, they are going to find it more helpful than not to have a football agent. And I say that for the same reason that I find it more helpful than not to have a clerk, because I want to be able to get on dealing with, you know, advising in law or arguing in arbitrations and not spending all my time arguing with clients about what my rate is or when they're going to pay me or that kind of thing, because it's just not, it's not what I'm good at and it's not what I want to do. And I think that's the case with most professional footballers as well.
Kieran, I presume from Raheem Sterling's point of view, just purely financially, not having a full-time agent would save him some money, would it?
Potentially. It could also be a false economy. If you've got somebody working on a full-time basis representing you in terms of your commercial interests, sponsorship and so on, it could be that they manage to sign up for another couple of deals, which actually more than cover their fees. In respect of Raheem Sterling, he appears to be taking, I don't think his final decision's been made yet, that he feels that he only needs the guidance and advice of a professional person on set dates and for set issues, and therefore that's sort of formed the basis of the rationale of his decision.
Now, Nick, you know I said earlier in the interview that they wouldn't be yes or no questions. Well, technically this is one, but feel free to elaborate. Can football actually regulate itself, do you think?
No, I'm going to say I will elaborate, because I think that the financial regulation that we've been speaking about is the best example of the problems with football regulating itself. I'll give you three examples. First of all, the distribution of broadcasting funds and other income between clubs and between leagues. Secondly, the failure of the League One and League Two previous salary cap plans, because they were not properly monitored and enforced by the Football League that doesn't really have the resources to do so. Thirdly, the failure of financial fair play in the Championship. And fourthly, now the failure of salary caps. When you look at all of those failures, a common theme in them is that often rules are rushed through by majority votes of clubs who are considering their own short-term interests. And in doing so, they're often considering how best to restrain competition from their competitors in the league who might have more money or they're worried about relegation or whatever it is. And they're focused on that, and they're voting for rules based on that. And that can often lead to quite irrational rulemaking. And so there is a good argument, particularly on the financial side, and also looking at things like fit and proper ownership tests, which are really also a lot to do with the financial side of football, to have an independent regulator looking after that side of things. And I think the collapse of salary caps and the current COVID crisis in funding will bring a new and greater call for that kind of independent regulation now.
I would guess fit and proper ownership are the four words we get asked about most on this pod in the year and a bit that we've been doing it. Why does it seem beyond the wit of football to come up with proper fixed criterion that illustrate what fit and proper ownership is? Because there are so many cases of, you know, people taking over clubs that clearly don't seem to be, to the ordinary football fan, fit and proper people.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a difficult one because football has come up with criteria of what is and what isn't fit and proper. It's just not always either interpreted that criteria sensibly or perhaps investigated it into the background of some people. I mean, some people seem to get away with no investigations at all. Others seem to have the book thrown at them before they've even filled out the form. And why that is often difficult to tell because these things are all done behind closed doors again. I mean, it's another thing that concerns me as a sports lawyer. It's that the greater transparency you can have in this sector, whether it's to do with arbitrations or whether it's to do with these types of decisions, the greater transparency, the better the results you get at the end. Where things are taken without proper processes and behind closed doors, you get these sorts of problems, and it's sometimes difficult to explain why you do.
Yeah, Nick, thank you so much for joining us on a Sunday morning. I know, like us, you're relieved to hear it's not being filmed. We like to end our interviews, Nick, with a couple of light-hearted questions, although, to be fair, only producer Guy would think this first one is light-hearted. He's interested as a Manchester football fan. The UEFA v Manchester City verdict at CAS was a split decision. Does that arise often in arbitration, and is it considered unsatisfactory when it does happen?
Well, I don't think that's a very light-hearted question either. So I agree with you there, Kevin. No, it doesn't happen often. I mean, it can happen. There's nothing wrong with it happening. The rules provide for it in all arbitration tribunals, as they do in courts, where there's a three-person or more panel. But it tends to be the case that, and I've sat as an arbitrator in sport often as well, and it's certainly been my practice. What you try and do is get consensus and you talk it through with your fellow wing members until you've got consensus. And so it is quite rare for one person, for example, or a minority to feel that they have to give a separate judgment. Mm. It is quite rare.
All right. Well, these two are definitely light-hearted. Would you make a good football referee?
No. I don't think so. Well, yes and no is probably a better answer. I think I would be fair. I strongly believe in fairness, even if it makes you unpopular. And so that's probably a good attribute for a referee. But I am probably not either mentally or physically well adjusted enough to put up with what a referee needs to do.
Yeah, I referee it used to be the annual North London v South London Comedians football match. It's a nightmare. These are people I've grown up with. I mean, having to threaten to send Alan Davis off in front of a crowd of 200, it's shocking. And the final question, and this is a perennial favourite. Which actor would you like to play you in FFP the movie?
FFP the movie. Yeah. Well,
it's on the way.
Is it? I mean, I'm assuming this isn't an obscure art house movie, but is a Hollywood blockbuster.
Yeah. While Kieran's listening, please don't mention obscure art house movies. It's a Hollywood blockbuster.
Right. Well, if it's a Hollywood blockbuster, I think I'd have to say Leonardo DiCaprio. Not because of his Italian heritage, his looks, or his age, or anything like that, but more because, you know, if you've got to try and make explaining the application of financial accounting standards to the amortization of player registrations look exciting, where else do you go? I mean, look at what he did in Wolf of Wall Street.
I think that's probably Kieran's favourite ever sentence on this podcast. and that's a very good place to end it. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us, Nick. It's been fantastic. Really appreciate it.
Thank you both.
Well, Kieran, in his own quiet, measured way, I think that was one of the most revealing interviews we've done for a long time. It was very interesting, wasn't it?
Yes, yes. And you know, the fact that Nick was prepared to answer every question we put to him, you know, he didn't ask for anything to be edited out or anything of that nature. You could see from the way that he did answer, very, very clear, very, very articulate and objective, while still wanting to get his measure across. And you know, without wanting to be too much of a hero worship, you know, I'm a huge fan of his. And for me, it was just wonderful to be actually to listen to him, you know, answer our questions, and show why he is the Lionel Messi of sports law.
Yeah, I was slightly reluctant to ask the Andy Holt question right at the start in case he thought I was being mischievous, but I'm glad he did because his answer was very diplomatic but firm, which I liked. I also like a man, Kieran, who already knows the answer to the question of who would play you in FFP the movie. Clearly, he'd been giving that some thought, even though we didn't tell him what the questions were going to be beforehand.
Yeah, yeah. And who's going to play your part? Have you worked that out yet?
Not quite yet. No, I'm not entirely sure I'd even be in. What part would I even be in FFP the movie? And working on the basis that I couldn't get a job playing myself on a TV show recently, I don't think I'd be in the film of FFP the movie. I was also very impressed as well, because, and I know I could, apart from the fact he praised your book, of course, but transparency was a word he used very often. And I thought that was interesting coming from a lawyer, because you wouldn't necessarily expect a lawyer to be arguing for transparency, but clearly in every aspect of the game, he says that's the biggest problem with football administration, basically a lack of transparency.
Yeah, if we have transparency and openness, it means that the number of disputes falls, which might appear counterintuitive from the perspective of a sports lawyer, but it does mean that you can actually have a set of rules where everybody knows where they stand before they get into an argument. So therefore, the type of cases that are more likely to come to fruition are going to be the ones which involve less of the lunacy which we sometimes see in respect of these cases.
Yeah, although slightly worrying, I think that the answer to the simple question, can football actually regulate itself, was no.
Yeah, and that was pretty unequivocal as well.
Yeah, yeah. We finish with a couple more shout-outs to clubs and fans doing very good work in their community. That Millwall podcast asked us to mention the Millwall Lions Food Hub, which is doing great things in southeast London. Happily to do that. And Jonathan Allsop told us about FC United's Food Hub, which has delivered more than 2,500 bags of food, plus other stuff like books, to many households across North Manchester in lockdown. Well done to them. If you've got any club community project to tell us about, it's questions@priceoffootball.com. It's questions@priceoffootball.com, which is also the address if you have any questions for our next questions pod on any aspect of football or anything you've heard today. And meanwhile, I shall hand you over to Kieran to say goodbye and ask him not to actually beg for votes.
Well, thank you. First of all, thanks for tuning in, folks. If you're enjoying the show, please subscribe, press that big purple button. And if you give us a review, if you give us 5 stars, if you're enjoying it, and also the feedback, we do appreciate it. But feel free to say whatever you want in the feedback. That doesn't impact upon the algorithms that are used by the likes of Spotify and Apple to determine our place in the charts. And it's only by getting a decent place at the charts that we can get people of the caliber of Nick DeMarco to come on the show. So thanks again and stay safe. The Price of Football. Price of Football.